From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The most successful e-commerce site in history, eBay, began as the Wild West of buying and selling online. Today, it's a commerce giant and still a little wild. A can of chunky soup on eBay, $275, a bulldozer, $12,000. Consumer demand dictates the price, and on eBay, anything goes. In this hour, inside eBay, the towering survivor of the online retail revolution. We begin tonight with word on the Philippines. An American missionary and a nurse kidnapped by Muslim extremists were killed today in a bloody rescue attempt by Filipino commandos. As the U.S. prepares to pull its own soldiers sent to train Filipino troops out of the region this summer, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said he is not willing to expand America's military mission there. New York Times reporter Eric Schmidt has just returned from the Philippines. I spoke with him earlier and asked him to describe the debate in Washington over U.S. military involvement in the Philippines.
The debate has really been over whether to push the training of Philippine forces by American Green Berets down to what's called the company level. That is, being able to actually go out on patrols with the Philippine forces as they go out in the jungles and hunt the Abu Sayyaf terrorists on the island of Basilan. It's a small island in the southern Philippines. Right now, the American trainers are confined to training at the so-called battalion level, essentially a headquarters training, and are not involved in patrols, which would put them at greater risk. Under the agreement under which the U.S. forces came in earlier this year, they would not be able to participate in combat operations, but they would be armed and be able to fire in self-defense if they came under fire.
So the company-level deployment would be reminiscent of the kind of deployments we saw in Vietnam that led to U.S. forces in combat.
Yeah, to some extent. That's obviously one of the sensitivities here, as the Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld considers the recommendations of his senior military advisors to go down to this level. Most of the military advisors, including the Green Berets themselves, who I visited earlier this week, believe that they can be more effective if they're actually on patrol with the Philippine forces and actually watching as their troops go out on patrol.
How does this whole debate relate to the death we learned of today of the American missionary who was held by the Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines?
Well, it's going to raise some questions, I think, about the training. Obviously, the Philippine forces that were involved here were some of their more elite forces, the so-called Light Reaction Company, along with some scout rangers. They're better trained. They were trained by U.S. Special Forces and have better equipment. But because of the agreement that the United States and the Philippines entered into earlier this year, no American combat forces were involved in this rescue operation. And I think if you talk to the families of the Burnhams, I think there's going to be some questions there and perhaps in other quarters as to just how sound a policy that was. If American commandos had been involved, perhaps Martin Burnham wouldn't be dead today, and the Filipino nurse that was also killed. I mean, there's no way to know, obviously. These operations go down in seconds. And even the best trained commandos oftentimes cannot help. But I'm sure these will be the kind of questions that will be raised, certainly by the families and their advocates in the days to come, and that both the U.S. military and the Philippine military will have to answer.
Eric Schmidt, as I understand it, U.S. forces are scheduled to be out of the Philippines by July 31st with so little time left. What's really behind this debate?
Well, it is, although that's somewhat of an arbitrary date. The original agreement called for 6 months training, which would expire at the end of July. Of course, the two governments could agree to extend that training under some other type of arrangement. So I don't think, even though commanders are saying they're preparing to basically pull out at the end of 2 months, I think there's always a certain amount of flexibility.
Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, has said, you report, that he would not be willing to expand the American military training there unless it was justified in terms of the greater risk and a longer-term military role in the Philippines.
That's right. Rumsfeld's bottom line is, how many terrorists have we killed or captured? And by his estimate, not so many so far in the Philippines. And so while it's great that our presence there, both in training the Philippine military as well as some of the humanitarian projects, have improved the quality of life on the island and perhaps dissuaded some of the local islanders from being sympathetic to Abu Sayyaf, it hasn't necessarily helped the larger-term objective of killing or capturing more terrorists.
Eric, with everything going on in the world, what is the real sense of the importance of this mission? There's an element of it on a small island on the backside of the Philippines. It seems a little bit arbitrary, almost frivolous. How does this stack up in terms of its seriousness?
Well, two issues there. Deputy Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, who traveled to the Philippines this week, actually made this point that perhaps the American public and even the military has become too focused on what's going on one small island that's roughly the size of Oahu. Mm-hmm. There's a greater issue, and that is kind of the long-term stability of the Philippines, which is a key ally in the Southeast Asia, of course. And also, it fits into Mr. Wolfowitz's broader theme of how Western nations, including the United States, can better engage what he calls moderate or more tolerant Muslim nations. And that is, the Philippines has about a 5% Muslim population that's centered in the southern Philippines, right where Basilan Island is. And it's in these areas that are much more economically depressed, where Abu Sayyaf and other terrorist groups have been able to gain a foothold.
But they've been there for decades, and it was never really seen as a critical issue of Philippine stability. What's up with framing it in that way?
Well, again, it's everything has changed in the wake of September 11th, and I think the United States, as well as its allies, are looking for places where they can help the governments deal with indigenous threats in a different way. Suddenly, what used to be just considered an internal problem for a government is now seen as much more of a global threat. There are some connections between the Abu Sayyaf group and al-Qaeda, although somewhat tenuous. And so I think now the United States is looking not just there, but other places in Southeast Asia, Malaysia and Indonesia, for instance, and doing whatever they can to assist those governments in making it more difficult for terrorist cells, whether they be al-Qaeda related or not, to find safe harbor and sanctuary there.
This is a kind of granular level of global involvement that seems almost impossible to sustain on a worldwide basis.
Well, that's why the U.S. is what it's doing both in the Philippines as well as the former Soviet Republic of Georgia and in Yemen is trying to take some trainers in, train up forces in those countries so that then after a few months the U.S. can leave and hopefully have those countries deal with the threat themselves so the U.S. doesn't get bogged down in a number of countries all over the world. There are no other Afghanistans, that is, entire countries that have essentially been turned into training camps for al-Qaeda or other places. But there are several countries, probably more than 60, according to the Pentagon, where al-Qaeda does have a foothold. And so the United States is doing what it can, working with these various governments to help, so that we will see a kind of a broad continuum of type efforts by the U.S. military in various countries around the world.
Eric Schmidt, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Eric Schmidt is a reporter with the New York Times. He spoke to us earlier from Washington. Legend has it that computer programmer Pierre Omidyar created eBay, the online auction site, to help his fiancée expand her collection of Pez dispensers. The truth is far more simple than that. He just wanted to create the perfect store. Instead of having sellers set a price, buyers would bid for an item and market forces would rule. This simple formula for online auctions created a hugely successful e-commerce venture amid the carnage of billion-dollar internet failures. Now, the company that democratized the internet marketplace is expanding its own vast online reach. Big brands like IBM and Home Depot now auction off their wares alongside Beanie Baby and model train collectors. What about you? Do you eBay? What have you bought or sold? And what can we learn from the big web idea that did not turn out to be a bust? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Adam Cohen. He's former chief technology writer for Time Magazine and author of The Perfect Store Inside eBay. Good evening and welcome, Adam Cohen.
Good to be here.
Good to have you. Adam, In a landscape of internet wreckage, eBay seems to stand as an amazing success. Why?
Well, it really is the perfect store and the perfect business model for the internet. It's entirely frictionless. They are just a middleman. They don't acquire any goods. They don't have warehouses. They don't need to ship anything out. So the profit margins are just huge in that kind of a business.
What's the scale of the eBay success? How do you describe it?
Well, the scale is enormous. There are now 46 million people using it, and revenue for the last year has been $1.1 billion. It's just extraordinary.
And in comparison to other internet companies that were of its generation?
Well, one of the themes in my book is that at one point Amazon tried to buy eBay. At another point, Yahoo tried to buy eBay. But after the bubble burst, eBay was actually worth more than Amazon and Yahoo put together. So that gives you an idea.
The CEO, Meg Whitman, walked away from a $30 billion buyout offer from Yahoo and must be happy today that she did if much of that was in Yahoo stock.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They've done many things right, but one thing that they did right was definitely staying on their own, sticking to their knitting, and just growing their business.
Adam Cohen, in your book, The Perfect Store, you dig into the origins of eBay and its many complexities. There's a lot of myth around the origin of this company. Tell it like it is. Where did it come from, and how did it get on the growth track that led to where it is today?
Well, it's really a serendipitous story. Pierre Omidyar, the founder, had been shut out of an IPO, actually. He tried to buy some stock on his Charles Schwab account and was shocked that insiders got it at the IPO price, and he paid 50% more. And he thought, well, that's not the way the market is supposed to work. And in the summer of 1995, the internet was pretty new. He thought maybe he could use the internet to create a better market where there were no insiders and outsiders. He put it together over Labor Day weekend of 1995 off of a computer in his home in a second bedroom in his house in Campbell, California. And he told all of his friends, he put postings on the internet, told them, come to my new online auction site. It's going to be up Labor Day weekend. And the first day was up, Labor Day. I asked him how many people came to the site. Zero, he said. But after a while, it began to word spread. It grew virally. And in particular, the early users of the internet, a lot of them were computer geeks who were looking for very cheap computer parts and software. And that's what traded most in the early days.
And at this point, what's the range of product, of buyers and of sellers that are on eBay?
Well, there are 7 million auctions going on at any moment. And, you know, the range of things you couldn't possibly imagine. Literally, people are buying real estate in large quantities. The biggest item now sold on eBay, incredibly, is cars. $1 billion a year in cars. But at the same time, you know, the Beanie Babies are still there. I heard about a woman the other day who supports herself and is putting a kid through school selling glass eyeballs on eBay. So you name it, it's there.
And of course, we all read the story, what was it, a month ago of NASA going to eBay to find old computer chips for the space shuttle that it couldn't buy anywhere else anymore.
That's exactly right. And people who are writing books, I was talking to my colleague at the New York Times, Frank Rich, and he used eBay to find old theater memorabilia when he was writing his memoirs. It's really an incredible resource for a wide variety of companies and individuals now.
So in your view, Adam Cohen, what does eBay's success tell us about what works and what doesn't work on the internet?
Well, you know, we've learned a lot about what doesn't work. What doesn't work is thinking that people will suddenly buy canned pet food that they'll have FedEx to them at home rather than picking it up at the store. What eBay did that's so brilliant is it actually leveraged the advantages of the internet. One thing the internet is very good at is hooking up people who are very far away in large numbers. And creating a market the way eBay did is something you can only do on the internet. You couldn't have a physical place where there were 7 million items up for sale with 46 million people milling around either buying or selling it. But all of that can be contained on one website.
And what's Meg Whitman's big vision for where eBay will or should ultimately end up?
Well, right now, the agenda is very much on the global part of the global marketplace that they're trying to create. They're aggressively moving overseas. They've had some real triumphs there lately. Yahoo just got out of Europe and decided that they would promote eBay from their platform. They are now revenues from overseas are 21% of eBay's total revenues, up from 18% just in the last quarter. So moving global is a high priority. One of their biggest blunders was a global blunder. They didn't get into Japan. They had a good opportunity to go 50-50 with Yahoo, and now they're shut out of Japan entirely, the number two internet market in the world. So getting back in Japan, expanding in Asia, those are all priorities. I think over time, though, what we're going to see is better use of technology. As the internet becomes much fancier, as more people have broadband, I imagine in eBay where you'll be able to, you know, in a virtual sense, walk around and pick up your items and, you know, maybe even some physical kind of way, you know, raise your hand for a bid. I think all that is, you know, down the road.
And we've heard Meg Whitman rhapsodize about how ultimately everything on earth can or should or will be sold online.
Yeah, because, you know, offline is just inefficient. If you have a store, you only get to sell to the people who happen to wander in. If you're going shopping, you only get to see what's on the shelf at your particular store. Why not put it all in one website where, you know, the perfection of the model can enter in, the right price will emerge, and you'll get the thing you want, not the thing that just happens to be available down the block from you.
We're talking tonight about eBay, the ultimate internet survivor. How do you interpret the resounding success of eBay? Are you an eBay junkie? And what's the biggest item you've bought or sold on eBay. The smallest, the strangest, what are you doing on eBay? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about eBay, perhaps the ultimate internet survivor. Our guest is Adam Cohen. He's former chief technology writer for Time Magazine. He's on the editorial board of the New York Times, and he's author of The Perfect Store Inside eBay. How do you interpret the resounding success of eBay? What makes eBay work, and what does eBay know that other web companies didn't know? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Adam Cohen, give us your analysis of how and why eBay pulled away from the pack of auction sites online and emerged as really the winner.
Well, there's a little-known story that actually talked about in the book that eBay was actually not the first online auction site. Mm-hmm. There was one called On Sale, which was up and running. It had a lot of money behind it, but it had a bad model. For one thing, it took possession of goods and then shipped it out, very inefficient. But also, it was very competitive. It tried to foster a sort of competitive, almost unpleasant atmosphere. eBay has always been a rich and warm community, friendly, believes that people are good. It's a place where people actually wanted to hang out and chat in chat areas. And that community has been an incredibly important part of eBay's success.
So understanding that it wasn't enough just to have an efficient place to buy and sell, but a place that people wanted to be, wanted to hang out as they considered doing that.
That's exactly right. And in the early days, people hung out on eBay for 12 hours at a time. They would list things, they'd make some bids, but then they'd go chat with their friends in the eBay Cafe, as it was called, or in specialized chat areas where all the Elvis Presley memorabilia people, they still have that chat area and many people meet there. And that's a stickiness, as they say on the internet, a reason to go there that most other internet sites just don't have.
We're talking tonight about eBay. How do you interpret the success of this enormous online auction site? Is eBay changing your world? Is it or will it ultimately change the whole world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Weston's calling from Farmington, Connecticut. Welcome, Weston. You're on the air. Hello, Weston. Are you there?
Hear me?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Thanks. I want to say, first of all, that I am one of those people whose life has been dramatically changed by eBay.
How so, Weston?
Well, I am sitting at my computer right now. Selling on eBay is not my whole job, but it is a significant part of my work as an antique dealer.
You're an antique dealer and you sell things that are in your store or that you have never even touched on eBay?
A little bit of both. I have about 40 auctions ending in the next hour, and they range from 1960s and 1940s glassware and dinnerware to perfume bottles and all sorts of different things.
Wow.
In some cases, I get better prices on eBay than I would in my store.
Now, we want to hear your comment, but tell us first when you first started buying and selling on eBay, Weston.
About 5 years ago. I think I predated Meg Whitman because Pierre used to sign off on all the community boards. And so there is a very marked difference in what eBay is today and what it used to be.
Well, let me. Did you have a physical store before you began selling on eBay? Were you already a dealer in the real world?
I rented a very small space in a store, mm-hmm. and I went to a lot of outdoor flea markets on the weekend.
And at this point, do you have a store, or do you do all your business on eBay?
I'm in an indoor flea market with a couple dozen dealers in Plainville, Connecticut, mm-hmm. and we are open only Saturday and Sunday from 9 to 4.
So eBay is really central to your business. How's it working for you?
It works well, and it works in fits and starts. I find some of the recent changes I haven't been pleased with. There was a recent fee increase that when I see my profits and I see eBay's profits, it's hard to see that was really necessary.
Meaning they're making out better than you are. And these were fees on, I guess, on each auction.
Right. When I list an auction and when someone wins an auction, I pay a fee. Both about, on the front end and the back end.
How about the community that you mentioned, Weston, that drew you and others in early on? Is that still thriving? Adam Cohen was just talking about it, as well as a competitive advantage of eBay's.
And I've given that a good deal of thought over the last few days as I've heard more about eBay. I don't know. I can tell you that I have utterly dropped out. I as because of the volume of business I do, there's a certain customer service avenue that I have available to me. So when I have questions, I go to these eBay service providers. I no longer go to the bulletin boards, except the only communication I have is with collectors that I've developed a one-on-one relationship with. And I do have some people that I sell to directly now, where I met them through eBay, and now we simply work together.
Weston, stick with us for a moment. Adam Cohen, Weston's suggesting that the community angle that you say was so important in elevating eBay above competitors may be losing a little of its vibrancy. Have you seen evidence of that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of the big themes of the eBay story. And remember, you know, when Weston got on, there may have been a couple hundred thousand people on eBay. It was like a small town. Now there are 46 million people. And, you know, that's bigger than any, you know, land-based city. So obviously it's going to be more impersonal. There still are many pockets of community, but the scale is now at a level that it can't be like the old days where literally people all knew each other. There were famous people with names like Uncle Griff and Pongo that everyone knew and everyone emailed with. It's a little too big for that now.
Weston, thanks for calling. Good luck with your 40 auctions at the moment.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for calling. I want to welcome into our conversation now Kate Delhagen. She's Retail Research Director at Forrester Research. Good evening and welcome, Kate Delhagen.
Hi, thanks a lot.
Good to have you, Kate. Kate, you followed internet retailing for a long time, back when people thought that it was going to be online direct selling. That was going to be the big thing, and now eBay has emerged as the survivor, I guess. What do you make of the company that strode out of the wreckage of so many online retailers?
That's an interesting way to phrase it. eBay was actually there almost at the beginning alongside folks like Amazon, who are arguably still standing, but also, as Adam mentioned, alongside folks like Pets.com, who are long gone.
And hundreds, if not thousands, of others.
Sure, thousands of others. We call that the sort of the demise of the dot-com era. Mm. And as you point out, eBay has become quite successful. I wanted to sort of define the role that Forrester thinks the role that eBay has played in the rise of online retail. And that's by saying they really invented or enhanced the person-to-person selling model, which is a tremendously fun and quirky way for consumers to buy and sell goods online. And in fact, many consumers, millions of consumers, have caught auction fever in the last couple of years, mainly because eBay has been such a powerful catalyst.
How important are consumers at this point in the business? The old image of eBay was Beanie Baby buyers and sellers and little collectibles. Now we see Home Depot's there, IBM is there, we're selling lots of cars. How much of eBay's present and future relies on sort of ma and pa amateur participants, and how much gets into the realm of big business?
I think that is a key challenge for eBay as they grow. As you just heard the last caller say, some of the individuals or the independents who helped build eBay's business and make it such a fun and quirky place to buy and sell goods really need to be part of the picture going forward. That's, in fact, one of the things that makes it such a powerful place to buy as a consumer, is that you know you can find almost anything, if not anything on earth, at that single venue. But at the same time, eBay has diversified. In addition to their initial person-to-person model, they've become a very powerful outlet as liquidator for many retail brands and brand manufacturers. And in fact, that has become a very large piece of their business, whether it's selling secondhand cars or off-lease cars or outdated inventory mm-hmm. from consumer electronics sellers or folks like Sears or the Sharp Rivage, who are using eBay to sell original products using the auction format. So they do have a challenge in terms of balancing the existing client base or customer base with their business needs to become an effective liquidation partner for these large retailers.
Adam Cohen, talk to us about how the big brands have come in here, Home Depot and IBM. How do they use eBay?
Well, in just about any way you can imagine, Disney has its own site where it sells a lot of Disney memorabilia. Sun Microsystems is actually selling $20,000 and $30,000 computer servers on eBay. So there's that going on, but there's also the mom and pops at the same time. The reason the big companies are important to eBay is that you get the quantity, but also moving up average sales price on eBay is very important for the company because they make more revenue off of the bigger sales. And their challenge is to keep growing in that direction while not losing the bread and butter, the mom and pops.
Listeners, a global e-market makes commerce more efficient, but does it make it more fun, more affordable? You can join us tonight. We're talking about eBay. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Matt is on the line. Welcome, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I think one of the reasons eBay is so successful, it's a paradigm shift in society, much like when Johann Gutenberg came out with the printing press. That, for the first time, enabled one-to-many communication. And, you know, the catalogers, the L.L. Beans of the world, they followed that with much success. And when the Internet came out, it finally enabled many-to-many communication. Anybody could be a buyer. Anybody could be a seller. And I actually worked on Marketplace MCI, the original stores in the Internet, with a lot of these catalogers, and they weren't all that successful just because they were operating in the old model when the Internet offered something totally new.
Matt, your line's a little rough, but we thank you for your call. Kate Del Hagen, here's Matt, and he's using that language of the bubble, paradigm shift and Gutenberg and the Internet. Does eBay keep alive some of those kind of revolutionary dreams that have taken such a thrashing since Internet companies and stocks crashed?
Yes, in fact, they do. They really made the what I kind of call the they brought the garage sale or the local classified market to a global marketplace. And by doing that, connecting millions of sellers with millions of buyers, which was physically not possible pre-internet, specifically pre-web, they've been able to create and keep this model not just alive but growing. And I think it is clearly here to stay. And we are fairly bullish on their growth potential, with some caveats that they have to manage. Not only the international growth, but the ongoing fraud threat and some other things. But they have brought an existing model of classified or garage sale mindset and consumer behavior to the Internet and have rode that, have been able to ride that curve.
Kate, looking at online selling overall, not just auctions, but everything, how big a piece of online retail is auctions, not just eBay, but all auction activity online?
That's actually a very surprising figure. Forrester's been forecasting and sizing the market for about 6 years now, and in 2001, there were about $47 billion of goods sold directly to consumers through the Internet. Auctions represented 16% of those sales, or about $8 billion.
Do you find that high or low, Kate?
It's very surprisingly high. It's a signal that consumers like the auction format, and it's also a signal that players like eBay, whether it's through their diversification as a liquidator or through the advance of Half.com, have become very, very instrumental in growing the online retail market.
And do you see that growing or shrinking as other kinds of online retail move ahead?
We see the auction slice growing over time. In fact, within about 4 to 5 years, we expect that one out of every $4 of transactions online will be through the auction format, as opposed to today where it's about one out of every $5. So we expect this auction format to continue to catch on with people, and whether it's for fixed price goods or for bid price goods, we expect it to take a larger slice out of the market over time.
Adam Cohen, how have the corporate executives, the founders and others at eBay handled this rocket ride? They haven't, the stock of course has gone down like many, but not anywhere near what some have. They've made enormous fortunes. What's the response to that been? What's the corporate culture there now?
Well, Pierre handled it in one of the most interesting ways. When I met him first, when I started reporting on the company, he was 32 years old. Mm-hmm. He was worth about $8 billion, and he had left the company, essentially. He'd moved to Paris with his wife and had a kid, and he's not a Michael Dell or a Bill Gates. He doesn't really want to be part of the company going forward. Jeff Skoll, his co-founder, worth now about $3 billion, also has left the company. Meg Whitman is now in charge, and one of her big challenges is to keep the sort of pure and idealistic community-based ideals, which Pierre imbued in the company, keep it with eBay now when it's a publicly traded company, when it has to answer to Wall Street every quarter on earnings. That has been a challenge. And some people have said that eBay is now too corporate and doesn't really have Pierre's ideals. And every time they get too corporate, and there have been instances over eBay's history that I actually talk about in the book, the community has risen up. There have been problems. So keeping true to the vision is definitely a challenge going forward.
Listeners, are you eBay junkies? What's the biggest item you've bought or sold on eBay? The smallest, the strangest? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Harvey's on the line. Welcome, Harvey. You're on the air.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I was listening to the enormous profits that eBay is raking in and thinking about the fact that it's a low-cost business to start up. And the question then of what why it isn't competitively constrained. And the obvious answer is that once you build up the number of buyers and sellers that it has, it becomes enormously difficult for anybody else to start up shop.
It sure does.
And attract people. So it strikes me there's sort of an antitrust regulatory issue here. What constrains eBay? from charging prices above competitive levels when there isn't a realistic possibility of a new competitor easily coming into the market.
Well, Kate DeHagen, dive into that. Is there a point at which, if eBay tries to take too big a fee on its auction sales, that it does become vulnerable to a competitor in spite of the enormous position it holds now?
Sure. I think there are actually two interesting points. The first is I would suggest people don't underestimate the cost of the infrastructure required to run that pretty massive operation.
Mm-hmm.
So they are investing some money in an ongoing fashion in just the servers and the boxes associated with running a business that large. So it's not like they're taking a lot of money and running. But having said that, they do have significant competition out there. There are people who are looking to steal some of eBay's customers, and those competitors include folks like Amazon, who has significant auction business and arguably has a large installed base of people willing to buy and sell online.
Now selling used books for among
them. Yeah, sure. There are folks ready, willing, and able to capture any eBay customer who would be interested in defecting should they raise their prices too high. And I would think earlier caller's comments about watch how they charge for things and don't alienate the small sellers is worth noting, and that is a concern for eBay folks going forward. And there are other competitors like Ubid who are operating on a much smaller scale, but also similarly positioned to capture people in the auctions mindset, whether they're consumers willing to buy and sell or retail customers looking for an additional place to liquidate goods. So they do have to keep their competitive senses very, very in touch with the market.
But Adam Cohen, we have seen in eBay the dynamic where if you've got most of the action, most of the stuff for sale, it's very hard to dislodge. People want to come where the big piles of goods are.
Exactly right. Pierre was saying from the beginning that people came to eBay. Sellers came because that's where all the buyers were. Buyers went because that's where all the sellers were. That's the power of the network. But it's also true that if they mess up, if they alienate the community, they could lose to an Amazon or a Yahoo. And in fact, one of the fun things that I came across in reporting this was that there actually is a movement of eBay radicals who have been trying to engender more competition. And in the summer of 2000, they led what they called the Million Auction March, where they moved a million auctions off of eBay onto Yahoo and competing sites to make the point that there should be more competition in the market. And they told me that they had done this, but I looked at the numbers, and it's true. They really did move a million auctions off. And
these are just citizen buyers and sellers who were on eBay and said, we want to flex our muscle a little bit.
There's a woman named Rosalinda Baldwin, another guy named Bobby Beeman. She's in New York. He's in Texas. And they got a whole group together, an online activist movement. Meg Whitman actually sat down with Bobby Beeman as the march was going on and said, you know, what are your problems? You know, what are your complaints? What can we do better? So eBay knows that, you know, the goose with the golden egg could be killed, and they need to, you know, they do have competition out there.
We're talking this hour about eBay, the ultimate internet survivor. We've been with Kate DeHagen of Forrester Research. Kate, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Listeners, what do you think? How do you interpret the resounding success of eBay? Is eBay changing your world? Is it changing the whole world? And is eBay collecting thrilling to you, or has it taken the charm out of rummaging for bargains? We're talking with Adam Cohen. He's former chief technology writer for Time Magazine and author of The Perfect Store, Inside eBay. You can join us as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about eBay, the ultimate internet survivor. Our guest is Adam Cohen. He's author of The Perfect Store, Inside eBay. What makes eBay work? And what does eBay know that other web companies don't or didn't? And there's this. A global e-market makes commerce more efficient, but does it make it more fun, even more affordable? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Evie's on the line. Welcome, Evie. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually have a very, very serious complaint against eBay.
Let's hear it.
My husband attempted to make a purchase in January, and he closed the deal with someone, and then that person never produced the item. It was a camera.
Did your husband send the money, Evie?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And the mechanism for paying for items like this is PayPal.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried again on the assumption that he'd had one bad egg and got defrauded a second time, although that time he managed to get compensation from the person involved, but he's still trying to get his money back.
And when he went to eBay, presumably you went to eBay or he did with the complaint, what kind of response did he get?
Oh, there is no real person to talk to. It's all done through emails. And PayPal was supposedly handling it, but then they just stopped handling it. They were willing to settle for a very inadequate return on what was like a $5,000 or $6,000 item. I don't even think he got half of his money back.
Evie, hang on. I'm sorry we don't have anyone from eBay to respond to that directly, but obviously a couple of incidents like that can make doing business there kind of expensive. Adam Cohen, let me put this to Adam, if we could. How common is this kind of complaint on eBay?
Well, I wouldn't say it's common, but it definitely does happen. And there are a few issues embroiled here. For one thing, PayPal is actually a distinct company from eBay. eBay has its own competitor in that space, which is the online payment space. It used to be called BillPoint. Now it's called eBay Payments.
These are the companies that take the credit card number.
That's right, and who sort of email payments. So mm-hmm. any problems with PayPal are probably not fairly attributable to eBay. That said, there definitely are people who do get ripped off who have not been happy with eBay's response. Some things eBay does do is it has insurance for part of the purchase price. It has a program called Safe Harbor where it tries to investigate and cure these problems. But from the very beginning, Pierre's position was that eBay is only a venue in which buyers and sellers meet. It isn't the insurer of all sales. In a way, it can't be, because if you think about it, mm-hmm. eBay can't run out and look at that vase and determine if it's real and then, you know, say, okay, go ahead and buy it. If they had to insure the validity of every item, they really couldn't do the business they do.
But how do they track down people who take the money and never send the item? Are there eBay police or how does it work?
There are, in fact, yes. They have a former U.S. attorney, a former, I think, INS inspector, and a significant size staff that does do that. But they also work with local law enforcement. But there definitely are cases like this. I would say, in researching the book, I've talked to many, many people who use eBay, and there are not that many cases of this, and very few people I know don't use eBay because of it. But it does happen, and it seems like the caller's husband really was, ripped off.
So, Evie, are you going back to eBay, or are you done with all that?
Oh, no, we would never go back to eBay. There isn't a human you can talk to. There is not a live person that you can get to interact on a major complaint of this nature.
So if you end up on the right side of the thing, you're in a happy city, and if you have trouble, it's difficult.
Absolutely. There's no way, no recourse. All we could do was keep emailing the seller and asking her repeatedly to make good on the return of the payment. She never had the item to sell.
Evie, we're sorry for your woe and hope that you eventually get that camera. Thanks for calling. Ed's calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Welcome, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I love the show. You've done a fabulous job.
Oh, thanks, Ed.
I wanted to talk about eBay from the perspective of the experience of knowing your buyers and knowing your sellers. I've got a fairly good reputation on eBay. I've been doing business on there since basically it started.
What kind of business, Ed?
Just buying and selling things. I mean, not as a full-time business, but just, you know, when I needed to. I mean, basically going out, I've sold land, I've sold golf clubs, I've sold, you know, a whole bunch of things that I've bought.
Land and golf clubs, that's a pretty good range.
Yeah, and I've bought books all the way through computer parts, wine, you name it. It's a wonderful world. But the neat thing about eBay is I've come to know a lot of people and interact with wonderful folks, from a guy who bought a golf club from me in who was in Hawaii, a fellow named George, who was wonderful and communicative, through people in Canada and in France and just all over the place.
So are you saying you think you can make out who's a good egg on eBay before you send the money off?
Well, absolutely. You can tell by the quality of their response about how much detail they answer questions. You can read the reviews that people have about them. You have to be smart about it. You have to know your buyers and you have to know your sellers.
Ed, is your selling on eBay a sideline, or are you making a living doing that?
No. It's just not even a sideline. I just do it as necessary. Mm-hmm. If I have something I want to sell, or if somebody said, you know, Ed, would you sell this for me? I'm happy to do it because I've got the reputation now. People know I'm honest and they know I deal squarely, and I know the system, so they come to me and say, yeah, can you liquidate this for me? And I'm happy to do it.
Ed, thanks for sharing your experience. Adam Cohen, how many people actually make a living buying and selling on eBay? I'm astonished at the number of cocktail parties and conferences where someone speaks up and says, I sell antique scientific instruments on eBay, and it's all I do for a living.
Yeah, no one knows the exact number, but a couple of years ago it was estimated at being 100,000. It's probably, you know, something like double that now. It's a huge force for empowering people to be entrepreneurial right now.
It's incredible. Let's get one more call. Ken is on the line. Welcome, Ken. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to leave a comment that I'm a network administrator for a medium-sized company here in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And I buy a lot of computer and networking gear, and it turned out that a lot of dot-com companies, in their demise, all of their expensive Cisco and telephone equipment ends up on eBay.
So it really is a liquidation forum that you're taking advantage of, Ken.
Yeah, but not only that, but what I've noticed when discussing this with other colleagues who are at other startup firms, mm-hmm. is that they just start their companies from other people's cast-offs.
So here's the plants fall to the ground and our fertilizer for the next round of startups. It sounds like you found the magic formula there, Ken. Thank you for your call. Adam Cohen, what about the issue of prices on eBay auctions? One would think bring prices down, but in this world where lots of little odd knickknacks and odd out-of-the-way things that you might have found in an antique store in the hills of Kentucky are now offered to a global audience, is it actually raising the prices of some kinds of objects, artifacts around the world?
It's a fascinating question, and believe it or not, economists are actually studying it on eBay. But what you do hear is you hear the complaint that it's commodifying everything. So, you know, it used to be that if you had some weird little object, you could get a high price for it. But now it has to compete with many other versions of that weird little object, and prices are driven down. But on the other hand, you also hear that everything on eBay now suddenly sells for the highest price in the world that anyone is willing to pay for it. So I've talked to many sellers who say, gosh, I used to get great prices on eBay. Now, you know, everything gets such a small price. And sellers who say, God, there used to be all these bargains on eBay. Now everything costs a fortune. And in fact, what's really going on is it's creating the perfect market and achieving the perfect price. It's smoothing out the imperfections that are out there in the offline world. So I think you're seeing a little bit of both of those phenomena.
The unintended consequences of perfection. Adam Cohen, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Adam Cohen is author of The Perfect Store Inside eBay. In a moment, the aesthetics of the eBay auctioneer. This is On Point. If a picture is worth 1,000 words, on eBay, the right picture can be worth $1,000. A new book that has compiled images culled from the digital photographs eBay sellers have posted on the website to promote their auction items has come out. Julian Germain is one of the editors of Useful Photography 2, the book that finds art in crooked, underlit digital images of porcelain knickknacks and eBay ephemera.
What people do is take a very quick snapshot image of an item they want to sell, and some people make quite a careful arrangement and other people just literally sit something on a table. But we felt that it was a kind of modern day still life photography phenomenon, and many of the pictures gave us a lot of pleasure. Some of them made us laugh, some of them were quite touching in a way, And we felt that it would be quite easy for us to start making a collection. So that's what we did. There are five of us, and we all, you know, would spend a few hours a week just collecting images, which we eventually edited down to make useful photography too. There's one picture of a hat, a fedora hat, and it's a very nice hat, but it's just sitting on a beautifully trimmed hedge. And, you know, it's a slightly strange image. You don't really expect to see a hat there, but it's beautifully positioned. The colours work very nicely between the colour of the hat and the colour of the hedge that it's sitting on. And it's just something that you don't expect to see. And I wonder, you know, if I ever wanted to make a hat, I would probably never make it like that. And actually, the picture opposite on the page is another beautiful one. I think they're trees from a kind of train set. You know, you can buy these little model trees. And somebody is obviously selling some of these little model trees, and they've planted them in a sheet of polystyrene, which is sitting on a table. But the polystyrene looks like snow, and it's sort of reminiscent of a mountainside image of fir trees sitting in the snow. Oh, yeah, one of my favorites is a photograph of a G.I. Joe life raft. It's a green life raft, slightly deflated, sitting on somebody's dining room table. I don't know. I mean, if you let your imagination run into this picture, you can kind of imagine that G.I. Joe might just get into it and get in the river. You know, it looks like somebody kind of believes in it slightly in a strange way. Composition is a very sort of subjective thing. Sometimes people have got a tiny little rug and they put it in the middle of the photograph on the floor. At other times they've taken a window frame and stood it in front of a sort of piece of satin fabric and stood it up. Oh, there's a beautiful picture of a mirror in here. And somebody has done an absolutely... I mean, I think it's probably the most beautiful picture of a mirror that I've ever seen. And it's in... I think it must be in somebody's garage or something like that. And so the surrounding around the mirror is black. But you can see reflected in the mirror sort of the street that they presumably live on. For me, it's this very nice feeling of place. One of the editorial team had this bonkers idea. If we hard, sort of case-bound one copy of the magazine, put it into this really sort of arty package, and held an auction on eBay in Holland to sort of announce the arrival of this publication. And it was fantastic, because of course nobody bid on it. So in the end, somebody from within the team, not me, I hasten to add, started bidding on it in the completely pathetic way that no doubt people who sell things on eBay do sometimes, to try and encourage things, you know. You know, it's not to be taken too seriously, you know, and there are probably some people who see it who will think it's an incredible amount of effort for very little reward. Some very sort of serious art people might feel that way. But on a slightly more serious level, if I dare go there, it is a sort of reflection of where we are as a society at the moment. You know, you look through Useful Photography 2, and there's maybe 600 or 700 photographs in there, and they are just the tip of an iceberg, and they show you sort of like the extraordinary position we're in, the things that mankind will make to sell. But at the same time, you know, you see literally references to life and death and very serious sides to the world that we live in, you know. I mean, the whole point of Useful Photography is that, you know, any issue that we ever do would be that these photographs exist in the world, and they somehow reflect the world that we live in an interesting way.
Julian Germain is an editor of Useful Photography 2. He surfs the web from his home in London. To view images from the book, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.